Michael, are you there?
I'm here. Howdy, partner.
What's happening?
What's shaking? What's crack-a-lacking?
You know, we have pretty much given up on like doing a traditional intro to this show anymore. Like, I feel like when we did we ever do one? I guess we never really had one. We never really had much of a format. I think it's tradition now for us to talk for 3 or 4 minutes before we even say the title of the podcast.
Right. People are like, is this? Did I just
the right thing
happen to someone's phone conversation? What's going
it's on? Probably what it sounds like with the old. we love the Anchor app, but we need to invest. We've been saying this. We need to invest in some at least mediocre microphones so that we don't just sound like we're talking on the phone, which is what we're doing.
Yeah. But. Well, it's like, do you remember like the three-way call, but the secret three-way call where you didn't know that there was the third, like only one knew that there was a third-party listener? Well, that's what that's our audience out there.
My friends used to do that to me all the time. I used to get so mad when like my friend would like call me and I'd answer and we'd be talking and it'd be like, man, I can't believe Ted the other day. And I'd be like, yeah, I know, man. I don't know what his problem was. And then like 5 minutes would go by and then I'd hear a cough and I'd be like, wait, who was that?
Like Ted, what did you hear that, Ted? What do you think about what Dave just said about you?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I'd like to think that we have our listeners, you know, in an intimate conversation with us. So yeah, it's just conversational, people.
We have a small group of listeners, but we have a tiny devoted audience and we love all of you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Every single one of you.
Yes.
So welcome to the Add More Mouse podcast. My name's Dave.
Hello, I'm Mike.
And we are two guys who just talk about Disney stuff. And we are completely different than all of the other Disney podcasts because this one is hosted by us.
That's right. Well, Dave, I heard there's only like two other Disney podcasts out there. Like we're only one of three. Yeah.
Okay. So coronavirus wiped out the 700 other Disney podcasts. Nice.
Yeah. I'm kidding. There are plenty of them out there. But, you know, I think we've picked some pretty unique miniseries.
Well, I tell you, that's been little inside baseball chatter for you podcast heads out there. It's, you know, it's not hard to think up topics to talk about. It is hard to think of stuff that hasn't been done 900 times.
Yeah.
You know, another friend of mine and I have been talking about starting a totally different podcast for like 2 years, and like, as soon as one of us has an idea, and it wouldn't be Disney related. As soon as we have an idea, even the really weird ones we come up with, as soon as you Google it, there's already three that exist that have done that idea.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's insane.
I know.
We are living in peak podcast right now.
Yeah. Hey, well, I was just on the road for a little mini vacation. I was driving 8.5 hours one way, which turns into more when you add stops, you know.
Oh,
but
yeah.
You know, and then another 8.5 on the way home. So you know, I was really eating up the podcast content out there. That's sort of like I kind of prefer it over music sometimes. It depends on the mood, you know. Like
yeah,
you know, maybe half the drive I'll do podcasts, half the drive I'll do music or whatever, or interchange them. But I mean, I think that, you know, that's why they're so popular now, because people just, it really helps a long drive go by.
Oh, yeah.
Commutes to work if you are driving
now,
to work.
You, like me, you work out a lot. So
yeah.
Do you ever listen to podcasts while you work out?
You know what? Oddly, I do, which is interesting.
Oh, see, I was going to say that I think people who do that are insane. But
well, it's funny. I listen typically to music. I usually turn on some Sirius XM stations for when I'm working out. But I have listened to some podcasts here and there while I'm working out. When I'm just doing, I don't know, it just kind of spices it up a bit. But
I used to be able to run and listen to podcasts. And just in the last like year to 2 years, I just like I need the motivation of like loud heavy music to get me going. Like I can't if I listen to a podcast, I just slow down and
anything cardio related, absolutely. Endurance, cardio, running, biking, you definitely need music and over podcast.
And for some reason a podcast, when in a long drive, podcasts hold my attention in ways that books on tape, I know they're not on tape anymore, but like audiobooks, they've never worked for me because I zone out. I don't know why that is, but like, it's just, I'll 20 minutes will pass and I'll realize I haven't listened to a single word that's been said.
Yeah.
And then I don't know what's going on. So I can't, I don't know. Yeah. Podcasts work in a way that those have never functioned for me. Right. But anyways,
well, hey,
this is not the podcast.
This is very
podcast.
Meta. This is a very meta.
This is not your, this is not Add More Podcast. We are here to talk about, we talk about any Disney stuff that strikes our fancy, or that we're a big fan of any and all rabbit holes that we discover along the way. In fact, I think this is like the fourth or fifth miniseries that we just kind of like stumbled into.
Yeah.
Because we basically do a miniseries and then go, oh, I guess it directly connects to this one. So we just finished a tiny 4-episode miniseries about Disney bombs, you know, box office disappointments. The final of which was Walt Disney's third animated film, Fantasia, which turns out in my research for what we're talking about today, which is Fantasia 2000, though it was a great underperformer at the box office, part of the reason why they greenlit this movie is because it made bonkers money when they did the re-releases in theaters later on. And they, and also in the late 80s, or maybe it was early 90s, it made an absolute massive amount of money on home video.
Yeah,
they sold like the 9 million VHS tapes of this thing, and like they made like $180 million off the re-release of this. So that kind of told them there was an appetite for it. They were kind of mistaken when you look at the box office for this movie.
Right, right.
But
So what we decided to do was conclude that miniseries on bombs, and then segue into a miniseries on sequels to the animated classics of Disney.
Yes,
so
which there are plenty, and I think we're gonna make this another mini series so that we can come back to it eventually. We learned our lesson with our massive mega series of TV shows featuring
trips
to Disney parks, which took 9 months for us to do. So we're probably gonna limit this to 4 or 5 and then we'll turn our attention elsewhere and come back to eventually kind of like what we're gonna do with the Disney bomb series. Because When you've got a company that's been around for so long, there's just a vast amount of stuff that you can look at. And I find the topic of box office disappointments in the Disney company pretty fascinating. Mm-hmm. And the sequel era is interesting too. Obviously, Disney's made sequels since the beginning of their, I think people wanted Walt to make a sequel to Snow White. They wanted him to make a sequel to Dumbo. I mean, people made sequels since Hollywood's been around. He was never much of a sequel guy except for like the TV stuff.
Right.
You know, they were constantly pumping out new versions or, you know, add-ons to things like Davy Crockett and stuff like that. But for the most part, you know, that was after Walt himself had kind of taken a back seat in their media production and was more focused on the parks at that point.
Yeah.
And this era in which this film was produced, along with the rest of that we're going to talk about eventually, are all pretty much Eisner era, where they realized that another way they could goose sales of their animated classics and to scoop up some, as LL Cool J would say, scoop up some paper.
I don't know the reference, but I'll go with it.
I can't remember what song that was from, but he says that.
Well. You know, any good podcaster utilizes the improv technique of yes and. So yes, LL Cool J, of course. Scoop them up.
If it's family appropriate, I'll play it on the end credits.
Okay.
I can't remember if it is or not. So, you know, they started just, they made sequels to The Lion King and to Aladdin and to Little Mermaid and to a whole bunch of others.
Oh, yes. Pretty much every one of them. Pretty much everyone.
Right. And I have to say, okay, so I was a Disney head back when they were doing this stuff. Not quite to the level that I am now, but I was a big fan. I loved animation as a kid. And even when these were coming out, I thought, like, you know, this really, to me, however lame this is, like a kid who's like 17 should care about what a giant company does to cheapen their brand. But, you know, I think it definitely seems when you're releasing movies that are called like Lion King 1.5, it's like, okay, you know, what are we doing? Like, are you so out of new ideas that you're just going back to the well for half a time.
That's the moneymaker right there. That's the cha-ching.
Right. And eventually, once John Lasseter from Pixar took over Disney Animation, after Disney formally bought Pixar, one of the things he said was we're done with this. Like, the era of us cannibalizing our classics is over, which is funny because then Pixar goes on to sequelize every single thing they've done. Cars, Monsters, Inc., mm-hmm. Toy Story.
Is there going to be an up to?
Don't think so. But there is, they are doing, what was the one I was thinking of?
That's okay. Well, you are right. They tend to do that. And I, most of these, when I think of Disney, I think there's so many parts of Disney I understand, but my mind always goes to these animated classics. And I think a lot of people equate Disney immediately to these animated classics. And so, like you, I also, growing up, I would every year these movies came out, because it was typically one a year, I'd go to the theater and see them, loved them, got the clamshell VHS. But when it came to the sequels that you're referring to, most all of them were straight to video. And mm-hmm. some of which I would rent at the video store, taking it back. Rent at the video store. I never owned many of them. I can't even remember if I owned any of them. But the straight-to-video ones, just sort of never really jumped out at me. So there's a lot of these in this miniseries we will not – that will be the first time I've seen them, even though I had seen the original.
Yeah.
But this particular film today, Fantasia 2000, is sort of the exception to the rule in that it was not straight-to-video. And, of course, it also was 60 years later
yeah.
that it was released.
And that's unlike – Look, I'm sure, we'll dive into as much info as we can when it comes to the making of those direct-to-video sequels. I'm sure there's some info out there about them. Probably not as much as your average Disney animated classic, right? So not to disparage the hard work that I'm sure went into making, the direct-to-video sequels. But this certainly, not only because it was a theatrical release, but because of what it is, which is, a celebration of animation set to music. I mean, a lot of love and care went into the creation of this film. And it's really interesting. I think on our previous episode, I had really started to give Michael Eisner some business about how this was him driving the bus on this, and that this was going to be his thing because he was fancying himself Walt's successor. Now, it's been a while since I've read the book Disney War by a guy named James Stewart, and it's a fascinating book. It's 600 pages long. It's a massive tome, but it's really interesting because it covers the entire Michael Eisner era, which is just a crazy period. He basically comes into the company when they're at rock bottom and almost being sold for parts from a corporate takeover that was attempted. And then he takes them back to the absolute top, and then he starts making some terrible decisions again and gets bounced right back out after 20 years. So it's an interesting book. I misremembered that. So it really wasn't him driving the bus on this. It was Roy E. Disney, which was Walt's nephew. It was Roy mm-hmm, Disney's mm-hmm. son, and who was very heavily involved in Disney Animation at the time. And one of the things, I don't know if we really covered this in our Fantasia episode, but a piece of information I came across a whole bunch in my reading for this episode was that, Walt saw Fantasia, the original, just the way he saw Disneyland, which is this is never going to be finished. We can, every couple years, we can bring it back out and we'll swap in new pieces, and the Fantasia name will be an experience that people will know what they're getting, but they'll go back to see it to see if there are classic pieces in, and then we'll put new stuff in there. And then obviously it did not do what they were hoping it would do, and that all went by the wayside. And then over the years, there have been attempts to do that, but nobody really pushed it the way Roy Disney did. And he had the backing of that success of the original's release on VHS to say, look, the name has value. So I hadn't really come across that when we were in my reading for the previous episode, but I came across it in a bunch of different sources this week. So that's what they tried to do, which makes more sense now that it has, you know, spoiler alert, this has the Sorcerer's Apprentice in a hole in it, which is an odd choice. I know. Because
we'll get there. Well, what you're talking about, this concept of potentially, you know, adding new segments and everything and keeping it going over time, I feel like could be possible now in the era of streaming. It's sort of an interesting thought that just came to my mind.
I don't think people would want, like, back when things were being re-released to theaters, I think you could get people to go because they wouldn't have seen it since the last time it was in theaters, and you could bill it as with new stuff, and yet might be missing stuff that they liked the first time, but they'll go to see what is new in there. I don't think that concept would necessarily sustain itself, because if people like a movie, they like a movie. They don't want you to mess with it, you know. Hi, Slider.
Right. Sorry. Yeah.
So, okay. I got questions for you.
You could hear that.
Oh, yeah.
He's not even in this room.
We didn't really talk about this on the last episode, but do you listen to classical music?
No, I'm not going to sit here and pretend I do.
I don't either. And I always feel bad. Music is like probably my most favorite thing on this earth other than my family. And
other than your family. Yes.
And, my life revolves around music. I love it. Still playing a band. I've played music all my life. Like my days revolve around, not revolve around, but like I soundtrack my days intentionally.
Yeah.
I've never gravitated towards classical music, and I listen to everything, jazz, metal, hip hop, like country music. I can dig pretty much anything. And I just am never in the mood for classical. It makes everything you're doing so serious. You're washing the dishes, you're working on the computer, you put some classical music on, and suddenly it's like everything's very dramatic.
It is. Dramatic is the word for it.
You want to have a cocktail after work and the kids are in bed and you put on a jazz record, you know, that's a laid back evening. You put on a classical record, it's just a very different vibe. So my next question is, had you seen this one before?
No, definitely not. I had heard about it. And when this movie came out, I would have been, you know, a freshman in high school, and was not something I was looking to go to in the theaters. And then just never saw it. How about you?
Nope, I hadn't either. And I worked in a movie theater in college, and it came to my theater, and I actually intended to see it and just didn't get around to it. And I don't think we had it in the theater very long. I always feel like it was kind of in and out.
I always forget that you worked at a theater. That is so funny. But yeah, I don't remember even hearing much about it at the time. I mean, I wonder how long it was in theaters. I know it came out, upon our research here, December 31st of 1999. So typically it's referred to as the 1999 movie.
Yes.
It basically was the 2000 movie, hence the title.
Yeah. And it went to our small, we had seven theaters in that theater that I worked in.
Yeah.
Seven auditoriums, and it went straight to the smallest one.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think it came out and didn't have a whole lot of expectation behind it. And it wasn't a complete, I mean, who's to know, because Hollywood accounting is always really interesting. But according to the sources I saw online, it cost somewhere between like 60 and 80 some million dollars, and it made like 90. So, I mean, for a lot of people, that would be a huge disappointment because they're looking to make a profit, not just break even on all that hard work. But I mean, it wasn't a disaster of a film, a la your John Carters of the world. but it definitely didn't do, I think, what they were probably hoping it would do.
Right.
And my only other real interaction with it was this last trip that I took to Walt Disney World coming up on a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it was last October that I went. We stayed at the All-Star Movies Hotel, which is kind of one of their budget hotels, although it's very nice. And we stayed in the Pixar side. So it's divided into a few sections. There's a Pixar side, like a Toy Story side. There's a 101 Dalmatians side. And then there is the Fantasia 2000 hotel.
Huh.
And I had thought that it was just Fantasia in general, because when you can find pictures of it online, there are gigantic, like, four-story tall brooms with buckets of water. And then there's the ballerina and the creepy jack-in-a-box that's from the 2001. And I didn't realize that the Sorcerer's Apprentice was in this. So I thought it was just the, like, representing both Fantasia movies, but it really is the Fantasia 2000 hotel, which is interesting.
Well, that's pretty interesting, because I never heard anything about that hotel, and that's a pretty random branding, if you ask me, for specifically Fantasia 2000.
It's odd for sure.
Yeah, I was just talking with someone about Fantasia 2000, and they said, wait a minute, what's 2000? Like, a lot of people don't even know that this is, I mean, a lot of people do, of course, and I'm sure all of our listeners know, but there are many people I talk to who aren't even aware of this being a thing. They know Fantasia.
I think when they made the building, they just wanted, because, like, the swimming pool is devoted to Sorcerer's Apprentice. So, like, if you go to the swimming pool, at the top of the swimming pool, there's Mickey in his outfit, like his robe and his, you know, moon and stars hat. And there's, like, water shooting out from him. So I think they just wanted that. And there really aren't any other characters from the original. I mean, I guess you could do dinosaurs from Fantasia, but it'd probably be confusing. So I think that's probably what they want. But it is interesting that they, you know, there's a gigantic, like, two-story ballerina, half-story, that thing, the jack-in-the-box. It's freaky.
Oh my gosh, is it ever.
And so you're walking past those, and, like, you know, there's, like, a three-story Woody and a three-story Buzz Lightyear and then a gross three-story jack-in-a-box.
Yeah, and I wouldn't have known what that was. You know, it's funny, because I would have thought that was, I don't know about you, but that was one of my least favorite segments within the Fantasia 2000.
I didn't like that segment.
Yeah.
No, and we can take that opportunity right now. We can dig into kind of the flow. I mean, obviously, just like Fantasia, the first one, there's no real storyline.
Right.
But, you know, I'll say this. There's a big mix in this film of computer animation and traditional animation.
Yes.
And clearly, Pixar and some other studios as well, but Pixar especially, I always look fondly upon traditional animation, because
Me
it
too.
Doesn't really come out anymore, and, like, I really love it, and I wish that people still made it. Now it's mostly the realm of, like, TV, where you can find a little more, at least looking like it's hand-drawn stuff.
Right.
But, you know, with this one, they were really going all in on augmenting what they were doing with computer animation. And sometimes it works, but I feel like it doesn't age well.
I know exactly where you're going with this. So,
and I think it's because with hand-drawn animation, let's cut you off, but
yeah.
I this is what I spent my day thinking about. You know, when you watch Snow White, I don't think it looks great. Now, granted, techniques got better over the years, and, you know, obviously a movie like Treasure Planet looks much different than a movie like Snow White, but Snow White does not look bad. It looks beautiful. You know, Lady and the Tramp is a beautiful looking movie. Jungle Book, even, which gets a lot of crap, I think that's a great looking movie. And
Cinderella.
Yeah. I mean, these films were the peak of, you know, people making animated films. And yeah, your camera techniques and the clarity might improve, but, like, people are still drawing pictures. It's still a human hand drawing pictures.
Yeah, talent.
And when you look at some of these older first forays into digital animation, it starts to look like you're like looking at old video games or something.
Exactly. Like, so yes, I completely agree. I was watching. So let me just, before we delve into each of the segments or each of the different parts of this movie, I wanted to say, I think to your point of this computer animation versus hand-drawn, et cetera, I think that the type of viewer that is going to enjoy this movie most is one that is going to appreciate animation and appreciate the technique that goes into it. And so I do think that what you're saying, you know, when you, the more computer you add, I feel like the less impressive the technique perhaps. But either way, I think people who are going to watch this, what you're going to get into, you're there's no, well, except for the segments in between this, the animation, there's no dialogue. It's music with animation, and there's a lot of flow and movement, and you're going to really be immersed in that. And you have to, there's no, you know, storyline that's cohesive throughout, like you said. So I just am saying this to say, you know, I think most people, when they go into this, they have to know this isn't a traditional movie. This isn't a traditional, you know.
It definitely is a worthy, I think it's a worthy successor to Fantasia. So I don't think in any way does it cheapen the original one. In fact, I actually think it improves on it in one way, which is that I think Fantasia could have done now. I'm not saying that I wish it was like this, but it would be interesting if the breaks in the original Fantasia are originally narrated by Deems Taylor, who was like an opera critic and very, very serious guy. Now, obviously Walt wanted to make a very serious piece of art. So I totally understand, I think, where his head was in the original Fantasia. But I kind of liked this one in that, now I don't really care about the, like, you know, the kind of strange star-studded cameos that are built into it. But I liked the kind of humor breaking up the segments. Like, I liked some of that.
Yeah.
It doesn't all work for me. It's kind of weird seeing Penn and Teller in there, because it's like, well, I love them too, but it, you know, it's a little weird. But like, I think it was kind of a nice, like, you watch this very you watch some really interesting pieces of animation, and it's kind of nice to have somebody bring you back down to earth and kind of showcase what you're about to see in a little more of a, in layman's terms, I guess, sort of.
Yes. And a lot of the people that are there as cameos are people who have had a long relationship with Disney.
Steve Martin and James Earl Jones. I mean, freaking voice of Mufasa right there.
Yeah, Angela Lansbury, voice of Mrs. Potts.
Yes. And I will say that James Earl Jones has the funniest. I genuinely laugh. I think that was the only time I laughed out loud. But he introduces the, is it the third segment?
Fourth segment.
Yeah, it's the one where it's a flamingo with a yo-yo. He says, leading up to it, he's like, and now we are going to look at the eternal question of what happens when man faces nature. And then he looks at somebody, goes, somebody hands him a new piece of paper and goes, oh wait, we're gonna look at what happens when a flamingo is given a yo-yo. He goes, who wrote this? And then it cuts, and I laughed really hard at that. I thought cut was really funny.
That was good. That was really funny. But yeah, so Penn and Teller are a little out of place because they don't have that long-standing relationship with Disney like a lot of these other folks have. But I think it's appropriate just because they're magicians and they're introducing sorcerers of practice.
I liked it. Yeah, I love their stuff, and so I was happy to see them. So I liked that part, and that's also sort of like a very, I don't know if Michael Eisner really pushed on that, but I mean, he's kind of known. One of the things he's known for is bringing celebrities into the parks. You know, when he shows up, that's really when they start getting, like, they put Ellen DeGeneres into the Universe of Energy. They bring Martin Short into the O Canada movie. They're really,
love that. You know how I feel about Martin Short.
I know. And we've talked about that before. You're wrong, and you'll realize it someday. But yeah, he was like very much wanted to infuse the parks as much celebrity as possible. And they, from what I read, I don't think he had much to do. do with that here, at least that I could find. But it did seem like it had his fingerprints on it.
Yeah. Well, and so do you want to sort of, you know, now that we've given sort of the preview.
Oh, now that we're 40 minutes into our podcast, we maybe should talk about what happens in the movie. Yeah, I guess so.
Well, sure. But I said what I did about the animation. You know, you have to go into this appreciating animation because every segment is a different animator or animators, different style, you know, and I think I like that. So when there may be some that other people prefer over others, and I think it's fun to kind of see the variety. One thing about that was when Bette Midler did show up as one of the people introducing, and she mentioned, I mean, I don't know if this is supposed to be funny or not, but she talked about how there are so many of these segments, these animated shorts that are considered and that are drawn up and have been submitted to be part of Fantasia that didn't make the cut. And she's like, how do I put this nicely? That just didn't make it. And I thought, I mean, is that supposed to be funny? I feel like it's kind of awkward to all the people that just didn't make it in the movie. It's like, okay, why are we drawing attention to that? So that was the only weird part of the movie I felt was like, I just didn't think was necessary, because she did talk about, here's a few that we tried that didn't make it. And you'd think, well, you know, they're like you said before, a lot of people put a lot of time and effort into these things, and I'm sure they were worthy, but just, you know, you don't need to rub it in.
Yeah, that was a little weird. And eventually some of those did come out. So some of the ones that she mentions, they kind of just got shoved onto like DVD releases. Yeah. Like one of them was a little Match Girl that was finished eventually in 2006.
Okay.
And it came out on the, it came out on, I think now, I mean, obviously it's on Disney Plus now. It came out on some DVD. There was another one that came out for consideration. Because actually they were thinking about doing a Fantasia 2006. And so they took some of the things that they had started to work on for Fantasia 2000. And then when that project was canceled, they just sort of like, they finished them up. Like one of them came out on the Lion King 2 DVD. And, you know, they just sort of like found their way onto weird releases. So yeah,
good.
that was a weird segment.
Yeah.
So basically the movie is just like Fantasia, and it's very short though. We should mention that. So, you know, whereas Fantasia, the first one, was incredibly long. I mean, it was like 2 hours and 16 minutes long or something like that. Mm-hmm. One of the longest animated film of all time, I think. It's still. I couldn't remember if it was still or if it was just at that time.
Yep.
Although it would have only been like the third animated film of all time when it came out. So that probably wouldn't be too hard to do. So it's this movie's like
75 minutes.
Yep. Minutes. It was a breeze, man, compared to I had to break Fantasia up in like three nights because my kids go to bed and I'm so tired at the end of the night. I knocked this out in the afternoon.
Yeah, you can watch this. You can watch that in almost the same amount of time it'll take you to listen to us talking about it. So
it's very true. And it's up to you to decide which is a better use of your time. So the first one is a Beethoven piece. Like I said, I don't listen to it. So it's Symphony No. 5.
Yes.
And this is probably the most like the original, the original Fantasia, where it's very abstract. It is
a bunch of shapes just taking form of other movies.
And I would say this is the one, unfortunately, it's the first one straight out of the gate. And yep. I feel like this is the one where the digital animation really sticks out. I don't mean to be mean, but it sort of felt like I was looking at a screensaver sometimes.
That's a great description.
It's a mean thing to say because I'm sure people spend a lot of time on it, but it just hasn't.
Well,
it's not bad. It's interesting to look at. And I will say this, because of their advanced techniques in when they're producing this, the syncing up to the music is pretty amazing. Like way better.
That's true.
Way more. I don't want to say better, but like, it syncs up to the music in a way that they really couldn't do for the original Fantasia.
Yeah.
So it's kind of keeps your attention a little more because it's just the rhythms, like the frames cut, the shots cut to where the like orchestra stabs are, and it's a little more of one piece, I guess.
Yeah, that first one, it's funny you mentioned screensavers. Now that's all I can think about, but
it's a mean thing to say, and I don't mean to disparage nobody's hard work, but it's how it's aged over time.
Well, hey, I mean, I thought it would, when you said syncing up to music, I completely agree with that. It really, and that's what I think a lot of this is. It's the motion with the music and the flowing. That's what you really don't probably appreciate unless you take a step back and think about just how much work goes into syncing that up. So,
yeah.
But now all I'm thinking about, though, is screensavers and how, you know, Windows 95, that's all I ever cared about.
I'm sorry to the artists that are listening to this. It's a totally entertaining piece, and it does not look bad by any means, but it just definitely, there's an aspect to it that is, that sticks out a bit, I'll say. Next up is a piece called The Pines of Rome. And this is the one that's introduced by Steve Martin. And basically, it's all about humpback whales, and they swim around, and then they leave the water and fly around, and then they somehow get up into outer space, and you know,
they get trapped in an iceberg.
It's a what one I, of them. I liked it. It's a little long, but I liked it. It was a little like, God, I sound like such a snot, but it's like, how many times can you see the whales swim past? You know, I liked it, but I also, this is the one where I kind of was looking at my phone like, wow, okay, what's going on here?
Well, this is the one I thought you were going to say was shoddy computer animation.
Oh, really?
That didn't age well. Because
I didn't think this one looked too bad. I didn't think it looked too bad, but I you're welcome to disagree with me.
Well, it didn't look horrible. I mean, I love the artwork with the Aurora Borealis, you know, the Northern Lights or whatever. And I did like most of the whales and how they were animated. There were certain times, though, I thought that it did look sort of video game-ish, like you said, like, you know, the Tomb Raider type.
Yeah.
I'm trying to find a good reference point.
No, I see what you're saying, and I would agree. And I didn't mind it. My beef is that I just felt like it was too long. And then up next is probably what I didn't ask you up top is what your favorite part was. So I'll go ahead and say that I'm not going to count Sorcerer's Apprentice because it's so good. So to say that it's my favorite of one of my favorite pieces of Disney, Disney anything. But I'll say that I think this third piece, Rhapsody in Blue, it's a Gershwin song. It's a fantastic piece of animation. It appears to be all hand-drawn. I don't know if they used any computer animation, then it was very seamless. It's introduced by Quincy Jones, which is pretty awesome too, and it's just
this is my favorite as well.
Characters with no words, and it tells a great story. It's totally unlike anything in the first Fantasia, or really this one too. It's fast-paced, it's jazzy, and it has its own feel, and I thought it was great.
Right, and I agree. It was my favorite as well, or at least one of my favorites. And to your point, it's different in a couple of ways. I think it's different because it depicts people in a more modern setting as well. A lot of humans in a modern setting. It was New York City, and you don't see that a lot. It's a lot of like nature or abstract or cartoony things. So this was cartoony, yes, but it was depicting humans a lot. And I really liked how it started with just like a single line and then drew all of these buildings and then drew all these people. And it just sort of was this like, I keep using that word, but it just really had this awesome flow, and the characters and the colors were really cool. And I read a lot of really interesting trivia about this too, in that, and one I'll bring up is that these characters all had names, even though of course they're not called by those names, but the animators do have names for each of these characters that were drawn.
Yeah. Well, I happen to be looking at the Wikipedia page, so I can tell you their names, Duke, Joe, Rachel, and John.
There you go.
But it's great. It's a really well-written piece. It's four people who all basically want something else in life, and they all manage to get it, and they all interact with each other without any of them knowing. And it's just, it's a really cool piece. And the music's great too. I mean, Gershwin is, it's a piece of classic music, but it's, he's a genre unto himself. And
the colors are so good. Great. It's just so cool.
You can't say enough about this. I mean, that's, if you don't feel like sitting through this film, pull it up on Disney Plus and skip to this section, because this is worth your time.
Yeah. The first part reminded me a little of an Etch-a-Sketch when they were doing
I could see that. And then we move on to, and am I reading this off Wikipedia? Yes, because I don't know anything about classical music. It's Piano Concerto No. 2, Allegro, yes. Opus 102 by Shostakovich. I do know how to say his name because I used to work in a music store.
Impressive.
And it's based on a fairy tale by Hans Christian Andersen called The Steadfast Tin Soldier. And this is the one we were talking about earlier. This is the ballerina and the jack-in-a-box that are featured at the hotel. And it's fine. The animation's cool. I think it looks really good. It just, compared to what it follows up, it just, like, man, I'm sure anybody who watched the Rhapsody in Blue section was like, oh man, we got to follow that. Okay, great. Because you're just not, anything after that's gonna look not great.
Yeah.
So it was fine. Also, like we said, the Jack in the Box is totally gross and creepy, and I don't know. It was fine.
It was fine. It was fine.
Fine. We pivot then into what we call the Carnival of the Animals by. That's what. I'm not going to say the composer's name correctly. Camille Saint-Saëns. This is the one that's introduced by James Earl Jones, and it's the flamingos.
The flamingos.
And they get mad at their friend who won't stop playing with his yo-yo. I actually really like this piece.
I did too, and it was short. It reminded me of, it's funny that James Earl Jones, who was in Lion King, introduced it, because it reminded me of I Just Can't Wait to Be King in Lion King.
Interesting, really?
Well, not maybe the concept or anything, but there were a lot of flamingos in that song. And the color, so the colors remind me of it, and the fact that the presence of flamingos, maybe that's the only reason why, and maybe because I was subconsciously thinking of Lion King when Mufasa himself was introducing it. I don't know. So, but do you remember that part of Lion King? Because it was a whole different color scheme than the rest of the film. Like, it was kind of a...
I remember
used a whole different animation during that part.
What it reminded me of was just the way it was animated was, if you've seen the film The Three Caballeros, the actual song The Three Caballeros, the way that was drawn and animated, like, it's very frenetic and very slapsticky, and I don't know, it reminded me of that a little bit.
The Three Caballeros, which is the least exciting ride in Disney Epcot. It's at least a contender.
How dare you, sir?
I mean, the Mexican Pavilion is so awesome. When you walk in, but then you get in that little boat ride, and I'm like,
I don't even care. Love it. Love it.
Well, I think they're going to reconfigure it to be Coco anyway, so that might amp up the game.
I love the Three Caballeros, but Coco is probably a better fit for that.
For sure.
Have you eaten at the restaurant there?
Yes. Oh my goodness. Right there by the volcano.
I could spend 24 hours in that.
Oh, me too.
It's not even that big. And I could hang out there all day. Love it.
The Cava del, what is it? The Cava, the cave over there. The margarita. You get all the margaritas.
I know. I
follow them on Twitter, but I forget their name.
So after that, we head into The Sorcerer's Apprentice, which is the exact thing lifted from the first one.
Yeah. Do you think that's a little lazy?
No, I couldn't find any info about why they chose to do that, except what they claimed was that this is, since Walt originally wanted it to be, oh, it's going to be a mix of the old and the new. We'll take the most popular of the old one. It seems weird because it is so popular, but maybe also is the fact that like Mickey Mouse wasn't super popular in 2000 and hadn't been really in anything for a long time. So maybe it was, they were just trying to get him back up on the screen so people could remember that he existed.
Well, the fact that Bette Midler just talked about how some things didn't make the cut, and then you're just going to copy and paste something that was in the other film.
Yeah.
That's why I kind of thought, like, well, it's sort of a gimmick because, I don't know, it's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't, because it's one of those things people probably think Fantasia, they think the Sorcerer's Apprentice, so they're going to, like, you know, jump up in joy when they see it, something familiar. But it's also a, well, you could have, you're just kind of, again, copying and pasting. So, well, I don't know. I don't care too much, trust me.
Considering supposedly how popular the VHS was, you'd think that the majority of people going to see this were already familiar with that. It's not like they had never seen it. They're going to see this because they probably like the original Fantasia.
Yeah.
And, but I don't know.
I mean, why not do, like, the Sorcerer's Apprentice 2000, you know?
Yeah, like that's my thing is something. Like, yeah, update it for, yeah, it seemed interesting to just lift it wholesale, and I mean, maybe they just needed to, maybe they were running behind. I couldn't find any info about it being like a time stamp, because they did spend money smoothing it out and trying to make it look
okay
a little clearer, because we haven't really talked about this yet, but we should, because my phone's almost out of juice, so if we don't talk about it soon, we won't get a chance to. This film was released in IMAX first, and so yes, in order
the
to
first
get
animated film,
yes, and yes. the first full length, and if you count 75 minutes as full length, but this was the longest movie that had been shown in IMAX, because IMAX reels are so big that it's incredibly hard to show an entire film in IMAX. Usually when a film, something like, I remember when the Dark Knight came out, there was a section in IMAX. So you would go see it in IMAX, but only like a 15-minute section was like in it, because that's the only part that can fit into the projector. I don't know. But heck of a sidebar we just had. And then, then we get into, we're in the final two pieces.
Yes.
And look, let's talk about the last one first, because it's the Firebird Suite by Stravinsky. And it's fine. This is reading reviews online. It seems like this was a lot of people's favorite part.
I was going to say that was a contender right with Blue Rhapsody. Do you not feel the same?
No, I think it's really good. This is probably my second favorite, but I think Rhapsody and Blue kind of blows it out of the water. But it's good.
This is beautiful.
The animation's really great. It feels kind of a lot like the end part of the original Fantasia, with like the evil versus the good, and there being nature involved. So yeah, it's really good. I really like it. And then we're going to back up and talk about the second to last, which is Pomp and Circumstance.
Great song. I definitely recognize that classical tune.
Yeah.
Gonna turn my tassel from one side of the mortarboard to the other.
So that's the issue I have. And you know, I had really given it pretty hard to Michael Eisner in our last episode, kind of unjustly, it turns out. But what I was thinking was that he is the reason why this is in the movie. And I'm going to read a section of the book Disney War by James Stewart. And this is like two or three paragraphs. And this is great. So I'm going to
please read.
All right. Yes. So, it says, after a trip to his son Eric's high school graduation, Eisner insisted that Edward Elgar's Pomp and Circumstance be one of the compositions featured in a segment. Quote, everyone can relate to Pomp and Circumstance, unquote, he said at a meeting with Roy and the animators, noting that he just heard it at his son's graduation. Roy said nothing, but everyone could tell from the strained look on his face that he didn't like the idea. Eisner proceeded to outline a plot for the segment. All the classic Disney heroes and heroines, Cinderella and Prince Charming, Ariel and Eric, march in a wedding procession carrying their future babies, which they would present. They would present in a ceremony.
Sorry.
There was dead silence in the room. Quote, okay, Roy finally said with notably little enthusiasm. New paragraph. When Eisner left, the animators were in an uproar. Pomp and circumstance might have been classic graduation music, but the animators and many critics deemed it mediocre, even by Elgar's standards. Roy hated the idea. The mass wedding procession seemed like something out of a Korean religious cult, and showing the hallowed Disney characters as married with babies, implying that they had engaged in sex.
Oh, God.
The very thought was unsettling. And so they go back and forth, and they come up with like four or five different versions for Eisner. And finally, Eisner says, quote, "I don't care what you do with it, but you have to use Pomp and Circumstance," he finally said. Roy concluded it was the price he'd have to pay to get the film made.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's what I was thinking, is he imposed his will in getting Pomp and Circumstance in. And it just kind of happened that they, I guess, wanted to throw in more Disney characters, so they put Donald Duck in.
Hey, I actually think that the inclusion of Donald and Daisy Duck was like a nod to the first Fantasia, which had Mickey. It was kind of like, okay, well, we're going to include another character, and you know, most of them are going to just be, you know, characters you don't know, and then this one's going to be the one that has the known character. But
it was fine. So here's why I'll get nitpicky, and I'm gonna pretend like these characters are real people for a second, because that's what we do. When you look at Sorcerer's Apprentice, I think it's a perfect distillation of like what Mickey Mouse's character is, right? And because he is kind of a, you know, the true this is ridiculous, but like the true essence of Mickey Mouse is that, yeah, okay, nowadays he's just, you know, a happy-go-lucky, you know, friendly character to all children. But he's also, in the original cartoons, he's kind of a
troublemaker. And adults.
A little bit, yeah.
Or a troublemaker.
Yeah, a little bit. And
not on purpose.
Well, no, but, you know, when you watch Sorcerer's Apprentice, it's just a perfect, like, that's who he is. He's a good guy, and he makes some trouble, but he feels bad afterwards.
Yeah, right.
And I feel like this doesn't, you know...
Doesn't fit because, Donald.
Well, he, you know, because he doesn't talk in it, and it's basically just him kind of being clumsy around Noah's Ark, and it's not bad. I don't dislike it. I just feel like, you know, if you're going to use one of the classic characters, like, I feel like some of the earlier Donald Duck cartoons from like the 40s, 50s, and 60s are so good and so well animated and genuinely funny. And I guess if I'm seeing a Donald Duck cartoon on the big screen, I expect it to be funny. And it's really not very funny. Like, it's, he just sort of like gets hit with a lot of stuff and falls from like great heights, and there are stars growing on his head, but it's like, it's not funny. And having a small child who I've watched a lot of Donald Duck cartoons with, some of those old cartoons are hilarious. They're really good. And I don't know. It just wasn't, you know, if you're going to spend the time on making that high quality of an animated film, I would have expected it to be funnier. That's all. That's all I'm going to say. I don't think it's terrible.
Right.
It just didn't do much for me, I guess.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I was, you know, thought the concept was okay. The execution was okay. Like, you know, it could have been better in both.
Yeah.
On both ends.
And I just wanted it to be, you know, I don't know. Donald Duck's thing is that it's supposed to be funny, and it didn't really, it's not terrible, but it's not, it's not what this 39-year-old man.
Well, you're right. When you can't hear Donald his ridiculous Duck. Voice, then you're right. His,
I know. It's
just, but by the way, wouldn't have been like, if they should have like been like really ridiculous with it and been like, we are going to include, since it was Noah's Ark, we're going to include like, for like crabs walking, but they're going to be Sebastian, and we're going to have lions.
You know,
but they're
I had the
be
same
like Simba, and they're
I had the same thought actually. I was like, it's kind of a missed opportunity because there's so many creatures. Like they could have had all the creatures from like the Jungle Cruise walking.
Yeah,
and there
Philippe,
is one...
the Belle's horse.
Yeah,
you know?
there is one really funny thing that I loved, which is as the animals are going in the ark. It like the camera kind of pans up and it shows, I think it's like a unicorn and a dragon and another creature like laughing and pointing at all of them like haha you idiots, and I thought that was pretty funny.
That is funny because then they didn't make it.
Right. They look like the bad kids who are like, you know, up smoking in the, you know, teacher's lounge or something.
But then they decide not to go in the Ark, and therefore they become extinct.
Before they're not around. Yeah.
Right. I like that.
That was a decent joke. There you go. Michael,
we are getting to time. I didn't think we'd talk this much about it,
at this point, before editing, we've talked for an hour. Fantasia 2000.
A couple friends, they were like, "Why 2000?" And I'm like, "Because it came out then," and they were really confused because they don't recall this. So for those of you who don't recall it, it's not a long watch. If you have Disney Plus, throw it on. It's something great to have on, like, even if you're not, like, all there. Like, you know, you don't have to, like, pay too close attention, but you might appreciate the animation, the music. I think it's really cool. It really is a great, and I think, you know, we're sitting here criticizing this and that about it, but, I mean, who are we? We're not, like, Yeah, well, that is what we do here on this podcast. But it was pretty quality. And
yeah.
I mean, I think that I would recommend it to people who are just looking for something, you know, after work, just
especially if you're a Disney history person like the two of us are. I think, you know, anything that's branded as one of the Disney animated classics officially is interesting in its own way, because they all, you know, they're not officially divided into eras by the Disney company, but by fans. You know, you've got like the Renaissance, you've got the post-Renaissance, you've got the kind of that brutal late 80s stretch that wasn't so hot. So, I mean,
this would be the post-Renaissance, right?
Yeah, this was basically some of the info I found was on a Slash Film article by Josh Siegel, who is a great Disney historian, and I think it's his point is like this is kind of like the official end of the Disney Renaissance. I guess he's right. This came out right after Tarzan.
Yes.
And Tarzan is kind of considered kind of on the cusp as well. Yes. So,
and this was 9 years in the making, I read as well.
Yeah, so it was a lot of Disney projects at that time. They started working on it slowly, and then once it's sort of like, once somebody shines a spotlight and goes, "When is this going to get done?" They hoof it and get it finished.
Well, this is it. It's part of the Renaissance, then, according to some. So I appreciate that. And so there's that. So what's not going to be part of the Renaissance are whatever we have left that is straight to video. What is our next endeavor in this miniseries?
Well, Michael, we are going to watch a sequel to one of my absolute favorite Disney films. The sequel to Lilo and Stitch.
Okay.
We will be embarking on a journey to digest Lilo and Stitch 2. Stitch has a glitch. He has a glitch. And we're going to find out what that glitch is and why he has it. And is it fun to watch?
I've never seen it. You've seen it many times.
I've seen it, but not seen it. So I have seen this movie. This movie has been on while I've been in the room probably 50 times because my son became obsessed with it. I have never paid much attention to it. So... Yeah, that's the end of this episode. Sorry for how late it was in getting published. Had a technical issue that cut off the whole ending that we recorded, and then I promptly got a bronchial infection, which I still have the remnants of, as you can hear. So, couldn't redo the ending until now. So, here's the part where I would say... thank you for listening, and I always mean it. It's so weird that people actually listen to this show. it just boggles my mind. And then I would say, here's hoping that we've helped you add a little more mouse to your day or your week or your avoiding homework or your drive or your gym. If you're listening to this at the gym, you might want to get some help. And then Michael would say something like, au revoir, or something, and I would laugh at him.
that's not going to happen because Michael isn't here, but we'll do it for the next episode. And anyways, thank you for listening, and we'll have a new episode out really soon. Bye.